Colonel Thymery One, can you tell me how and when you came to be in the army, please?
Yes. When the war started, I had left school and was destined to go to Cambridge University, which I did in October 1939. But after a year, I thought it was time I joined the army. I would have been called up probably in any case. So I joined the Cambridge University OTC, and I enjoyed the work there. So off I went and joined the Territorial Army in October 1940. And before very long, I was in the army. And I was posted to a training regiment. I joined in the ranks, posted to a training regiment, and after a few months, I was sent to an OCTU at Lark Hill and was eventually commissioned into the Royal Artillery in August 1941.
How did you feel about going into the artillery as opposed to the infantry or cavalry or something?
Well, my father had quite a bit to say about this. He was in the gunners in the 1914-18 war. And, in fact, when I was commissioned, I joined the same regiment that he'd served with in the First War.
Had he been an officer himself?
He had, yes. It was an Edinburgh regiment, so I hail from there. And
were you born in Edinburgh?
I was, yes. So it was the same regiment that he'd served in, although under a different number.
What happened to you next?
Well, we had a number of stations, all in Scotland, before we were sent overseas. And we embarked on a very large CPR liner, the Empress of Japan, which was in the dock at Gurik. And this was in June 1942. And at that time, of course, we did not know where for where we were destined. It was I had one amusing experience while we were waiting to sail from Gurik, and there were five troop ships in the dock there. Being a Scot, I had learned to play the bagpipes at school, and I took them wherever I went. And the evening before we sailed, I was persuaded to go up onto the sun deck of the Empress of Japan and to play to the assembled multitude. And all the soldiers and people were leaning over the rails of their various ships, and it must have been many thousands of them. And I well remember playing to them and being greeted with a certain amount of cheering from these lads who were leaving home, as indeed I was. And after a long journey, we landed at Cape Town. We didn't go direct. We went halfway to America, as far as I remember. And we had two very splendid days in Cape Town, being entertained by the local people who were famous for the way they treated these troop ship convoys.
What other things did they do for you?
Well, I remember coming off the ship, and there was a queue of cars, mile long, off the Cape Town people waiting to take us to their homes, look after us while we were there. Unfortunately, our stay only lasted 2 days. And then we landed in Egypt.
So you hadn't run into the enemy on the way?
No. There were one or two scares, one or two submarine scares, but I think most of them turned out to be whales. No, we had a peaceful trip. A rather luxurious trip. With 7-course dinners, because the ship had been victualled, I think, in Canada. It was a CPR ship. Gin slings were a penny a tot, I seem to remember. And then when we landed in Egypt, of course, we came down to Earth with a bump, because there it was bully beef, biscuits, and sweet potatoes.
What condition had you arrived in after all this high living?
Well, we were all rather fat, I think, and not having had much exercise. You can't take much exercise on a troop ship, which is so badly overcrowded. And naturally, before we'd been there more than a few days, most of the regiment were suffering from jippy tummy. This used to happen to everybody out there, and after a few days it used to go away. But while it lasted, it was unpleasant. Then after a period of acclimatization and training, we were sent up to the Alamein line to prepare for the famous Battle of Alamein towards the end of November of 1942.
Can you tell me about the equipment of your unit at this stage, please?
Yes. We were equipped with 25 pounders. Wonderful gun. And we had, before we left Scotland, of course, we'd had them long enough to know the drills and to become familiar with this equipment, because it was a relatively new gun.
Why was it such a good gun?
Well, it was accurate. It was quick firing. It was easily handled. And it was robust. And we never had any trouble with it. And the enemy, I think, very soon became rather frightened of the 25 pounders because of their high rate of fire.
How did it compare with the famous German 88mm?
Well, I'd never been on the receiving end of a 25 pounder. I had, of course, been on the receiving end of these 88s. It used to come out over with a rather a frightening whistle, and at high speed. The 88mm gun, of course, was a triple-purpose weapon. It was anti-tank, anti-aircraft, and field. But I don't think it was as mobile as our 25-pounder, from what I can remember.
What was the kind of morale and atmosphere in the army in Egypt when you arrived?
Well, I think before we arrived it had got very low. But by the time we got there, which was about the time that Monty was given command of the 8th Army, and he was famous for his communications and his issue of orders of the day. And very quickly, we and others, of course, became conscious that Monty was around, and we were led to believe that things were going to be different. I'm a great Monty man, I must say, and there's no doubt about it that he did an awful lot to restore morale, and I think it's well known what he did to do that and to root out the dead wood from the Delta and to stop this defeatist attitude which seemed to have got hold of everybody.
What kind of dead wood was there?
Well, I don't know, because it was there before, but I think the it's said that Cairo was full of staff wallers. No. Who really didn't have a job to do, but they made the most of the Gazira Sporting Club and the pubs and restaurants in Cairo. And I think Monty soon got wise to these chaps, got them either out or up a bit nearer Jerry.
What was your unit whipped straight into the front line?
Yes, straight into the firing positions for the famous Alamein barrage, which took place on the night of the 23rd of November.
23rd of October?
Sorry, 23rd of October. 23rd of October, yeah. Yes, that was our baptism of fire, as it were.
What do you remember about going into those positions and about the barrage?
Well, it was all done fairly secretly. The positions were prepared before the guns came up. The men went up and dug gun pits and the slit trenches and the command posts, so that on the day, on the 23rd of October, guns moved up in the evening into prepared positions.
Did you go with the men to prepare those positions?
No, I didn't, because my job was in the battery command post. Anyway, it all worked really well, and I think the enemy were largely taken by surprise, because there were a lot of gunner regiments taking part. There were just short of 1,000 guns, I believe, who took part in the big barrage.
What was your job at the command post?
My job, I was a lieutenant in those days. I was a fairly junior subaltern. I was what was known as ACT CPO. The ACT stands for Assistant Command Post Officer. And my job was in the battery command post. And I was responsible for the calculations and the working out the data for the guns.
Were there any snags that arose as far as you observed in the work that was being done there?
I remember on one occasion, it was about the third day, because the Alamein battle went on for about a week. It was about the third day, we were due to fire a program that night. And it gets very dark in the desert. And I was sent off to collect the data for this program. Unfortunately, I omitted to take a compass bearing because the where I was going was about 500 yards away. I collected the sheets of data and set off back, as I thought, to my own command post so that we could get started on the calculations, but somehow I got lost. There were other guns firing, and which made me somewhat confused. And I was getting a little bit worried because I had in my possession some very vital information. But luckily, Patrick Commander was getting worried about my absence and was shouting my name. So I homed in on his voice and all was well. But it was a lesson, because in the desert there are no landmarks, and compass bearings are really quite essential if you're going going anywhere at night.
Had you taken a compass with you?
No, no. Anyway, that was one little thing I remember.
How far from the guns was the command post?
Oh, quite close. Quite close.
Just a few hundred yards?
Yes, yes, if that, yeah. But when where I had to go that night was the regimental command post, which was, as I said, 500 yards away, something like that.
What do you remember about the famous barrage itself?
Well, it was very noisy. And it wasn't a succession of bangs, if I can put it that way. It was like the rolling of drums, because there were so many guns taking part, that it was just a steady, thunderous rumble of noise and flashes. The whole sky lit up because all these guns started firing at what was then known as zero hour, which was, I think, about 10 o'clock somewhere at night. So it was quite a rumpus. You couldn't really hear yourself speak, because although you were behind your own guns, there were other guns behind you firing over your command post. So there was deafening row coming from all directions.
What did you imagine it was doing to the Germans?
Well, one didn't think of it at that time, although I suppose, on reflection, one should have felt sorry for them, because there was an awful lot of stuff going over. A lot of it was on German guns, gun positions. A lot of it was on infantry positions. But it must have been exceedingly unpleasant.
Because the Germans always had this reputation for digging deep and well in.
Yes. Yes, well, bits of the desert, you can't dig very you can't dig very deep. It's more a case of building up with any rocks you can find, so you build a wall to protect you, rather than go down deep into the... because it's not all sand. A lot of it is very hard.
Did you feel that it was an historic turning point in the war at the time?
Yes. In a way, one did. It was described, I think, by Winston Churchill later on as being the not the beginning of the end, but the end of the beginning. One didn't know, of course, during that week what was going to happen, whether Alamein, the Battle of Alamein, was going to become quite so famous as the sort of turning point. And one didn't think about these things at the time. All he thought about was getting on with the job.
What happened once the barrage had occurred to you?
Well, it went on into the early hours of the morning. Then I think we bedded down to try and get some sleep, because the following day and for the virtually the following week, the guns were in action constantly, although we moved our positions further forward, and one had to find one's sleep when one could.
Can you take me through your memories of the rest of the battle?
Yes. We didn't have a lot of interference from the other side. Maybe we were lucky that our gun positions were not badly shelled during that time. But we did have the odd visit from the Stukas, very unpleasant aeroplanes. Dive bombers with a used to come screaming down on top of us, and you always felt that they were aiming for you personally. And we had one or two vehicles destroyed, and we had one or two casualties as a result of these Stuka attacks.
Would they be able to destroy the guns?
If they'd hit a gun, indeed they would. But they never did. They used to go, I think, for anything they could find, whether it was a vehicle or a gun position. But the Desert Air Force were always present and used to chase them off. Well, flies, I suppose. Everybody talks about flies in the desert. And they really are quite unspeakable flies on your food.
Any different from having them here in England?
Oh, surely. I mean, they used to be in squadrons. Not just one or two, but they used to descend in vast quantities. Especially if one spilled some liquid on the... we were prohibited from allowing any liquid to be spilled on the ground, because that used to attract the flies.
Even water?
And they came... Yes, even water. And they used to appear from nowhere. Our rations were of the hard tack kind then. We sort of lived on bully beef and biscuits. And occasionally, being quite close to civilization, we used to manage to get supplies up from the naffy of tinned stuff, which added some variety to our to our rations. And the other thing, of course, was tea, lots of tea. One was always drinking tea. And they, hot tea did a lot for one's morale if everybody began to suffer.
How healthy or otherwise did you keep once you got over the initial problems with jippy tummy?
Oh, very much so, I think. We had enough to eat, and I think nowadays some people tend to eat far more than's good for them. But we were all very fit. A jippy tummy, yes, came and went. There were other things like desert sores that used to affect people.
Did you get them?
No, I didn't. No, but they used to arise from a cut, which became infected, and they were very nasty. Swellings used to appear, but otherwise we were tremendously fit. Then after after the breakout, when the enemy turned around and pushed off, we followed across the desert up to a point. And then we were taken out of the line, which was a disappointment because we wanted to take part in the chase. And we sat in the desert training and resting at a place called Tumimi. Mines were quite a feature in the desert. Anti-personnel mines and vehicle mines. And I was appointed as the regimental mines officer, not because I knew anything about them, but I was sent on a course to learn about the German mines in particular and the Italian ones. And I spent a lot of my time instructing the members of the regiment in these wretched things, how they worked, and how to deal with them. And I used to have demonstrations and explosions and